You know, lest I get too maudlin here, it is great to be back. I'm in refirement. I still look in the mirror and say, you're on fire. Go forth and set some souls ablaze as yours is. There'll come a time when I look in the mirror and I stay at home. But I ain't there yet. I ain't there yet. It's interesting. Carolyn, my life mate, who wasn't remembering what I was speaking on today, she said, knock them dead. She could have said, break a leg, well, that's bad too. So here I am, and I look forward to mingling with you following the service in the patio. I want to dedicate this sermon first off to my dear cousin, Mary Catherine. She's named after my mother. We just celebrated her 76th birthday last week and learned in January of this year that she had an inoperable brain tumor. Actually, it could operate on the brain tumor, but that would give you probably upwards of 6 months, and if you didn't operate, you'd get four. She just passed her 76th birthday and is struggling at home, blessedly not in much pain. And something that she did is a lesson for us all. Mary Catherine sent out a love note a couple months ago to all of her family and friends saying, thank you for the ride. I love you. And I also want to pay homage on this Memorial Day weekend to all veterans of military service, families of military service, who served our homeland with honorable devotion. And especially to those families who may have lost a loved one in wartime conflict. My motivation for today's topic is manifold. It's not my only song, but it's my most crucial song right now in my life. And I'm going to try to sing it to you today. First off, I, like my cousin, am in my 76th year. And as I look out, along with many of you, you're in your home stretch as well. You may have read the relatively recent piece by the American oncologist and bioethicist Ezekiel Manuel Rhymes' brother, fine composer, writer, on why he hopes to die at 75, contending that living too long often proves to be an immeasurable loss. Well, Emmanuel makes a provocative and edgy case, but on the whole, I don't agree with him. There's nothing magical about closing out at 75, is there? As long as you stay consciously, positively, intentionally, strategically aging, which is what I'm still blessedly able to be and do. Second reason for today's theme, I owe God a death. My two best male friends, along with my brother, my brother's 78, going on 79, still an active counselor with rock groups and CEOs and going around the country to try to help sisters and brothers through the torment of public and private difficulty. And I did something with my brother. I'm sort of the initiator. I'm the more sentimental, maudlin one of the two of us. There's only two of us. And I called Phil up. He's in the Bay Area. And I said, Phil, fly down to Burbank. I'm driving up to Burbank. We're driving over to South Pasadena where we grew up. And we're going to drive around. And we're going to visit all the old haunts, the vacant lots, Jerry's house that burned down when his mother didn't put the cigarette out that night, and that place where we wrestled, and we're going to stay a couple nights, and I want you to sing me some of the songs you've written, and I'm going to sing you some of my songs as we sleep in the bed together. And I said, this isn't the last time we're doing this. We also talked about what he wanted at his memorial service and what I wanted at mine, because we won't both be there at the same one. So we got to swap notes now. And I said, every year I'm going to bug you and call you up, and we're going to find a place near home where we go through this same spiritual litany. But I lost my two best male friends apart from my brother. They died during this last year, and one who was eagerly wanting to halt a pain-saturated existence let me out. I would go and visit my friend in his nursing home. Then I'd have to go, and I'm pretty resilient. I've done this for a while. But I'd have to then go to another nursing home and sing, because I was struggling with the fact that my brother didn't have any spark, any juice left. And then my other dear friend, psychologist, died of an unknown premature illness taken too early. And both of these brothers were scheduled to speak at my memorial service. And I ended up speaking at theirs. And I'm reminded of Thornton Wilder's poignant line, there's a land of the living and a land of the dead. And the bridge is love. The only truth. The only survival. Yes, only love conquers death. Only love outlives death. These brothers and my dear cousin won't return in person, only in love. Only in love do I hold them still. And will I be held? And will you be held? And one more reason, my first book I wrote 31 years ago, at the spark of my beloved father-in-law, he said, you go for it. Generation to generation, passing along the good life to your children. And it was based on the Jewish ethical will, where Jacob sat down with his in-laws and outlaws and said, I'm going to pass on some morals from my odyssey. Take what you need. Dump the rest, resemble what you want to resemble, but I got to pass on this ethical will. And now I'm working on poetry. I'm not a poet, but as my days dim and dwindle down to a precious few, so does my writing. You know, those lengthy essays get short-circuited and shortened, and now I'm into Zen and haiku and tanka poetry on conscious aging and mindful dying. Why? Because that's where I am. That's who I am. I sing in nursing homes. That's one of my beloved passions, and the other day, there was a new guy that came and sat about 5 feet away from me. He was kind of close, because somehow he wanted to soak in the music. I knew it, not initially. He seemed kind of edging into my territory, but as I got to know Jesus, he wanted to feel the music. My sermon title comes from the quote from the essayist Wallace Stegner, who wrote, I've been lucky. I came from nowhere and had no reason to expect as much from this one life as I've got. I owe God a death. And I owe the earth a pound or so of chemicals. Now let's see if I can remember that when my time comes. Picture two children talking to one another around a tree, and the younger one says, "It's a beautiful tree, isn't it?" And the older one says, "Oh, you bet it is. But it's a shame that we won't be around to see it when it's fully grown." And the younger one moans, "But why? Where are we going?" You see, young children don't really envision death or a finish line, certainly not their own. They understand sleep and separation, but not death. We have our trouble too. God knows we have our trouble too. We tend to resist mortality at every turn. Death happens, but not to us. Sorry. It happens to us. Note the recent AARP magazine, good magazine, ARP. Lead article, front page, 20 ways to live longer. It's always about living longer. How about three ways to live stronger, to live thicker, more meaningful odysseys with the time with which you're blessed? Three ways, two ways. Death comes sooner or later as a relief or as an outrage. And we need to be prepared. As W.H. Auden says, we need to consent to die. I was on the Commission on Appraisal for the UUA for 6 years, 2003 to 2009. And sadly, we got hundreds of requests for updating and deepening and thickening our principles and purposes so that they didn't go only a couple strides beyond a Rotary Club of statement. We can go deeper than that. But we got to deal with forgiveness, which is missing. We got to deal with God, who's missing. And we got to deal with mortality, which is missing, not even mentioned. And some of us struggle mightily to make that happen, and lo and behold, due to procedural matters, it didn't pass the General Assembly in 2009. But when I'm long gone and underground, there will be other sisters and brothers of the younger ones coming on who will pay homage to forgiveness and mortality and love of God. Elizabeth Kubler-Moss, Ross and Raymond Moody, I mean, top-notch doctors and psychiatrists and thanatologists, did heroic work dealing with those who were dying. And even with the clinically dead, they interviewed them often when they returned for a time. And they found that all those that had been clinically dead said, it's peaceful, it's serene. And that's resourceful. And that's calming and comforting news, is it not, to all of us? But no one really knows what happens when you're actually gone. And so I'm a benevolent agnostic. What does that mean? It means I don't anticipate a life after life or a life after death. I don't even hunger for one, but there just might be one. I'm a universalist. I came in on the spark of love. I've been loved during the course of my life beyond deserving, and now when I go out, I will still be loved. I affirm that. I believe that. I hold that. I try to resemble that. I don't argue about it. I don't discuss it. I don't hold groups on it. Just try to be it. The love that brought me into being. And that's where my mom and I came close, she from her Christian perspective, I from my universalist. Whether or not there's life after death, there is love after death, and that's enough a love holding me, a love holding you, a love holding all living entity. We rest in that love. We're contained in that love. We're embraced in that love. But whether death is final or not, it remains real. As the World Health Organization recently reported, the world death rate is holding steady at 100%. You know, at our memorial services, one of the things we do well, and I always invite newcomers in our congregation, I say, you know, I got a memorial on Thursday afternoon. I know you're new. Do you mind if I ask the family if you could just sit in the back inconspicuously? And invariably, the family does not deny that request. And so people come and sit in the back, and I say, I'm asking you to do that because we do death well. We do it honorably. We do it honestly. A lot of stuff we don't do that well. But death isn't one of them. And when we have a memorial celebration, we say at the outset that Joe Doakes has died, and you and I are alive, so we know who's still breathing in the room and who isn't. The spirit may live on, but the body of the dead person is irretrievably expired, and that difference must be saluted rather than camouflaged in euphemisms like he's gone away, or she's passed on, or transitioned. Being dead means being dead. A fellow human being has been placed in the ground and will never return to touch and be touched. Death is mysterious. Death is unknown. Death is real. And it's not only inevitable, it's natural in the overall sweep of things. About 5 million years ago, something happened on this earth that both dwarfed and made possible every succeeding event. Up until that time, death, as we understand, didn't exist, but neither did life. All the living that was done by a kind of organic slime made up of algae and amoebas, whose life was one of continuous existence, growing at one end and sloughing off at the other end. And finally, life as we understand it, truly individual life, mussels and trilobites and crabs and spiders and human beings, emerged, and a whole series of worlds was on its way. If there exists any part of living creation, any person that we love, that we must say this is possible because of death. For without death, there would be neither that which we love nor the ability to love at all. That's how much we owe to death. But I'll go even further. It's not only inevitable and natural, it's desirable. Not always. I will not make friends well with the death of a 10-year-old or a stillborn. Premature tragedies. But I want to talk about how I don't want to live forever. I was on a TV show, a few years ago on immortalism, about the philosophy of immortalism and cryogenics. And the leader of the workshop that was interviewing me was relatively unfazed by my remarks until I unabashedly announced that even if I could live forever in my current condition, I'd likely turn down the offer. I didn't hanker for everlastingness. And he kept trying to persuade me that anybody who was anybody wanted to live forever. And I said, I want to die someday. I want to complete my journey someday. I only get one death. I want to live it as gladly and as meaningfully and as lovingly as I can. I mean, did you ever hear of an evangelist describing heaven in terms of the challenges waiting to be faced, or in terms of passion, or toil or justice? No, it's always in Elysian fields. A Palm Springs with a year-round irrigation system. Heaven is characterized by terrible constancy. No further growth. No difficulties. No change taking place. Destitute of variation or wrestling. How boring. How eternally boring. But let's put it positively. Death's presence intensifies my capacity to love and my desire to create meaning this afternoon. My dad died at 81 and a half. So did my father-in-law. It's about the average length of a man's existence. Some get more, some get less. But my days are numbered, and they're precious. As the psalmist says, teach us to number our days. Why? That we might apply our heart unto what? Unto merchandise and trophies and more shopping escapades? No, unto wisdom and compassion. Teach us to number our days that we might apply, we got a job, might apply our hearts unto wisdom and compassion. If we had an eternity, how many of us would clean up the environment? How many of us would show up this next weekend in the gun control workshop and protest? How many of us would dare to grow a beloved community where we're planted? How many of us would raise healthy and honest and honorable offspring? How many of us would volunteer at the homeless center? How many of us would do much of anything of much importance if we believed we had an eternity in which to do it? Raise your hand. I don't see many hands. You see, again, you only get one death. So I want to live it as boldly and as compassionately and as energetically as I can. A good death doesn't mean I'll die peacefully, although I'd like that. I want to say something about my cousin. She lives about a mile over that hill. She's been separated from her husband. They were married 40 years. He retired and said, I don't really know you. I don't want to be with you. And she said, I don't know you. I don't really want to be with you. They've been separate for 12 years. Haven't lost touch. He's come back to live with her at her final days. That's not for everybody. But she has a better death because of the presence of her estranged partner. A good death is more than going to sleep one night and not waking up, although I'll take that too. A good death is when I go into the ground essentially clean of regrets and resentments, current, up to date. Do you have something you want to say, be, or do before you go or someone else goes? What are we waiting for? Now, I've had to make peace. We all have kind of bugaboos and hard edges and impossible fantasies that we got to make peace with. And I got to make peace with the fact my name ain't going to last forever. It's sooner or later, and probably sooner, it's going to be lost the children, the grandchildren, some in-laws, some outlaws, some friends, some congregations. Books are taken to the dump. You're gone. The love lives on for a while in some hearts. And then it evolves. And blessedly and hopefully somebody keeps the gift of love of which you have been a part. The gift of love keeps that gift moving and spreading. That's our prayer. That's our hope. So, my dear mortals, my dear friends, in the end, death justice comes to everyone. In order to make room for other creatures to be born on the scene. Something that Carolyn and I did at First Church, and it ties in very much to your beautiful memorial garden here. We would meet with new members, prospective new members, and we would talk about the rights and the risks and the responsibilities of joining our beloved community. And we would ask, what do you need from us? What do you want from this community during your stay in our midst? And go deep. Tell us the real stuff. Where are your hurts? Where are your hopes? So that this can be your home. And then we would ask them, what can you deliver us? What can you bring singularly, uniquely, preciously into our beloved community? And sometimes those conversations would go 30 minutes and sometimes a couple hours, and then we'd say, we got more. Like San Diego, we got a beautiful property with which we were blessed, and I'll never forget the guy, Alan Rosencrantz, a blessed memory, back in 1957. He said the greatest thing he ever accomplished in his entire life was finding that site in Uptown San Diego and pressing the congregation to buy it and to build on it and to grind to make it happen, just as you are grinding and expanding and making this a more spiritual and practical and reality here. I mean, bathrooms on the hill, okay, and more. But we would take Roberto and Maxine, and we would take them outside, and we'd walk, and we want to show you the canyon, because we got, if you've been at First Church, we got a canyon behind there, and we scatter cremains here. It breaks the law, but we scatter cremains here, and we have rites of passage here, and we play with our children on the plateau here. And then we'd come up the hill, and we go to the memorial wall. And then we'd sit on the bench there and we'd view the names as you are viewing your names now. The spiritual economy of having a name and a birth year and a death year. Not all the flowery stuff. Equal playing field. Name, birth year, death year. Rhoda Lopez of blessed memory was the spark plug for doing this 50 years ago, along with James Hubble, who's still living in his mid-80s. James Hubble, Rhoda Lopez, Jerry Tebalt, and now they put together something on your property as well. Honor that. Invite your newbies to know why that's there. And we would sit there and we'd say to the newcomers, we want to introduce you to the other members of the community who are no longer with us. And we'd recite together a passage from Isaiah, which is placed on the wall. For you shall go out in joy and be led forth in peace. The mountains and the hills before you shall break forth into singing. And all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. Shall clap their hands. Shalom. Salam. Namaste. Blessed be and amen.